excursions into the Encyclopedia Britannica are always interesting, if not always illuminating. In the 14th edition of this distinguished handbook, there is no entry of any kind under the word soul. It is simply completely ignored. Turning to the older form, anima, by which the soul was recorded by Aristotle, we find no entry under that. Hopefully we turn to psyche to see if this will be more profitable. There is a brief entry under this word, summarizing the fable of Cupid and Psyche, containing no intimation or suggestion that the word has any other meaning. So we turn to psychology and find there the opening statement, psychology is the science of the mind. Thus the soul, as we are more or less inclined to think of it, receives no major heading in this work. There is no doubt that by checking the index, we will find many articles bearing upon the religious and philosophical meaning of the concept of soul, but it rates no major entry, no mention. This is more or less the result of a trend that has been going on now for better than a century, in which the effort has been consistently made to identify the internal life of man entirely with his mental and emotional structure. It has been taken for granted that all older concepts were more or less exploratory, they were seeking to understand a certain internal part of man, but that all of this exploration has come more or less to naught, and what remains is the simple fact that inside of man is a mental instrument, and that this mental instrument, which also has emotional factors involved in it, may be and should be scientifically considered as the only soul that man has. This, of course, is utterly contrary to the very institutions of philosophy from which even the term psychology originally came. Psychology does not mean literally the science of the mind. It means actually the science of the soul. But in order to have some comprehension of value in the use of this term, the soul, I think we must spend some thought and consideration in trying to estimate how the more ancient groups of people, scholars, mystics, philosophers, considered this part of knowledge, this part of philosophy which deals with the human psyche or anima and its involvement in mortal concerns. There have always been two distinct points of view on this, and perhaps the conflict between them has led to the confusion of the present day. To one group, the soul represented the internal self. It represented, therefore, in broad terms, all of man, apart from the body and its energies. The soul was therefore the person in the body. It was the soul that actually constituted the thinking, feeling, moving force within man. It was the soul that bestowed character. It was the soul that gradually, through the vicissitudes of life, came to dominate the material organism and transform it into an instrument for psychic purpose. The soul was, therefore, a true being in itself, and more or less inhabiting the suburbs of an invisible universe. And it was the soul that, animating the body, entering into it, transformed this body into a living thing. This concept of soul we find among most ancient religious and philosophic groups. There was a second group, however, possibly inspired by the early philosophies of the Egyptians, that held that the soul was a kind of overtone of the body, that the soul actually was something like the Greek idea of the immortal mortal. The soul had a beginning because it arose from man's internal reflection. It had an origin because it was created out of the very life of man. But having once come into existence, it became an eternal thing, unfolding and developing from the mysterious psychic seed that had been planted in the structure of nature from the very beginning. Thus, to these people, the soul was like a flower or a plant, with its seed in the dark and mysterious earth of man's spiritual nature, and its blossom radiating out into the various phases of enlightenment which man attained through his evolutionary process. It was the soul that really constituted the body of experience. It was fashioned out of the labors of man. The 12 labors of Hercules contributed to the creation of the soul. And that being in which there was a mature soul, or a soul grown up in wisdom and experience, was a hero, a person of great spiritual endowment. The soul, therefore, really constituted an over-self, much in the quality of Emerson's oversoul. But this over-self was something that man had to build. Much as in our ordinary way of life, man builds, through experience, his attitudes, his character, his disposition, his temperament, and the very maturity to which he ultimately attains. The soul growing up in man, therefore, was like a person passing through life, learning as it proceeded, gaining certain lessons, and accomplishing in older years a kind of wisdom, a wisdom arising out of living itself. The soul was consequently this wisdom body. It was this enriching character within man, becoming ever more, and by its own growth leading the body in ways of wisdom and truth. The Eastern peoples more or less follow this same concept, except that they extend the pattern to make what we might term the psychic self as something which evolves not through a single lifetime, but along the whole chain of re-embodiments included in the concept of reincarnation. Thus, the soul is that which is re-embodied. It is that which continues to grow behind the changing faces and forms of embodiment. The soul begins with man, begins with his earliest evolution, but continues in an unbroken sequence of growth, passing from one body to another, gaining some new instruction, insight, or understanding from each embodiment. And it is the soul and not the person that grows richer in wisdom. The soul, therefore, becomes, at any given point or time in the evolution of consciousness, the leader of the personality. Within the soul is locked the experience of previous lives, meaning that in some instances we observe persons born with greater erudition and insight than others. We see some more skilled and more gifted. We see the rise of genius. We behold those whose aptitudes and abilities are extraordinary. To the Eastern mind, these represent soul endowments accumulated through the long cycles of rebirth. So we do have two essential concepts, one being that the soul is the person, is the being, the other that the soul is this something that grows up between body and spirit, filling the interval between the two, acting as a bridge which becomes stronger and more adequate for the transmission of consciousness from within or experience from without. It is around this concept that the soul is something that is building with man that psychology gained its consolation and differentiated its own point of view. Psychology, however, has usually taken it for granted that man has only a single embodiment. Therefore, that the soul has its origin, its growth, its maturity, and its end within the span of a human lifetime. But it is in the soul, even in this concept, that what we might term the richest part of life is unfolded. It is the soul also which becomes the source of the various pressures and intensities which mark individuality. It is this soul, variously conditioned according to science by both heredity and environment, that the individual must turn to for the understanding of his own inner life. His life consists not only of his conscious experience, but of certain subconscious or unconscious experiences, which can become powerful forces in the modification of his character. So we come to certain simple concepts about this, by which we translate certain levels of activity in terms of psychology. We say the conscious mind is that part of man's mental life which responds normally to the various stimuli which are the expectancies of living. We can say, therefore, that two persons, A and B, may be involved in this. A is a friend of B. B has always been kind to A. Therefore, A is fond of B. There seems to be no problem here. We can explain the reason for this like in the natural tendencies and temperaments of these people. We find there is no mystery whatever in the association of these two persons. Each is reacting according to obvious circumstances, circumstances which we can explain without any consideration of dark, mysterious elements. But we may take another A and B for a momentary comparison. A knows B, and from the first day he met B, A heartily disliked him. B has done nothing to injure A. B is not aware of any reason why this antagonism should exist. B naturally likes A, but A naturally dislikes B. Now why? This problem is no longer so easy of solution. We can no longer put together some evident and obvious elements and say this is cause and effect. We now find A reacting in a manner inconsistent with environmental phenomena. A is not fulfilling expectancy. A is under some kind of a conditioned pressure. So the problem must arise to find out, if we can, why A, who has not been injured by B, and may have received favors from him, still dislikes him. To find the answer to this, psychology seeks to probe into the subconscious part of man's mind. It seeks to discover, if possible, hidden reasons for the animosity that exists. One of the simplest of all these hidden reasons could be similarity, or perhaps association. It is quite possible that sometime in his life, A has known someone resembling B. This other person in some way was unfair or unkind to A. Therefore, when A meets B for the first time, this old hurt, this wound, this unhappy situation is refocused, and A associates B with a previous injury. Thus, he naturally has an antagonism, which will remain unless he is a big enough person to overcome the subconscious prejudice. Here we see another type of pressure moving less obviously under the surface of A's personality. Out of the study of A's secret pressures, therefore, a certain type of psychology has been developed. It has attempted to discover the reason for unreasonable mental and emotional conduct. To some degree, it has been successful in this, but in some cases, it has been almost completely unsuccessful. Also within this area, there is another problem with which psychology has been still less adequate, and that is where it is not a matter of A disliking B, but that A has a deep and wonderful gift for music or art, and B has none of these characteristics. B is comparatively giftless. He is simply an extremely ordinary person. A is an extraordinary person. Now, the question of the psychological pressures of excellence, this question is more difficult to solve than that of prejudice. The answer we would naturally seek in the classical way, whether A has been subjected to some environment in which he had peculiar advantages over B in the attainment of genius. This may or may not be a fruitful line of research. Probably three-quarters of the time it is fruitless. The next question is, can we trace this from heredity? Is it possible that in the background of A, there have been great artists and great musicians and great achievements, even though several generations back? Tracing this is, of course, increasingly difficult as we retire where fewer and fewer records are available. But often there is almost nothing to indicate that this is the solution. It may well be that A comes from a family of five children. Of these five, he alone is talented, but all the others share in the same heredity. This office question, which is at the moment more or less shelved for future consideration, it will not fit into the approved pattern of things, but the human mind is very slow to change patterns that seem to be reasonably satisfactory, whether they are applicable or not. So we then have to try to find out, if possible, how it happens that A has entirely different endowments from B or from other members of his own family. And this would seem to point out the necessity of increasing the perspective on the psychic life of man to include more than one embodiment. It would seem necessary to assume that A carries a potential, that this potential came from somewhere, and that this potential was not an accident. It was not something that was merely fortuitously bestowed. It is easy enough to fill the universe with accidents if we want to think this way. But this thought very seldom contributes anything to the advancement of concrete knowledge. We must then assume that all abilities have their origin in some reasonable cause. And here's where psychology gets itself into one of its primary difficulties. Being unable to explain any cause that is consistent with its own concepts, psychology is forced to fall back upon an abstract concept of heredity that cannot be demonstrated for lack of data. Or it must fall back upon the fortuitous belief that somewhere in the environment, recognized or unrecognized, the solution to the mystery must lie. Or else it must take the ground and circumstance that some individuals are endowed and some are not, for no good reason. Psychology has been dealing with the problem of no good reason for some time. It has been forced to assume too many accidents. And it has also been forced to associate the individual with too many modifying circumstances over which he has no control. From this approach, we finally come to the principal dilemma from a moral and ethical standpoint which psychology faces, namely that it forces upon us an amoral universe, a universe in which there are no values, where things simply happen, and there is no excuse for their happening. There is no reason why one individual should try harder than another, because there is no probability that effort will ever be actually rewarded. Rewards are not in terms of efforts, they are in terms of accidents. While this, in the very abstract laboratory approach, may be comparatively meaningless and contribute very little to the complication of human life, when this reaches out into society and becomes a dominant thought or a dominant opinion or a dominant belief, it does and has undermined man's ethical moral life. It has given him a peculiar attitude toward things, an attitude essentially unlawful and meaningless, an attitude in which values as such no longer have any distinguishing boundaries. a universe in which anything can happen, and nearly everything does, and there is no particularly good explanation for the greater part of it. The ancients would not accept this. Perhaps they were too simple in their thinking, too direct to acknowledge such a concept. Perhaps they were too wise to accept it. But in any event, they would not build their universe upon this idea of incident and accident. They insisted that all things in nature had reasons, had explanations, that everything that occurred, occurred according to some reasonable plan, pattern, law, or truth. Consequently, that the differences in human life, human behavior, human attitude, human estates must be lawful differences, not accidental differences. And the only way they could solve this was by extending the lifespan of the human being so that that which was not accomplished in the present life could be traced to a previous embodiment. And that which was not worked out or fulfilled in this life must be extended into a subsequent embodiment. In the ancient concept, the primary end was that justice should be universally applied, whereas at the present time, the concept of justice has very little place in most scientific thinking. It has no bearing upon the psychology of accidents with which we are so heavily dominated in modern thinking. Now, psychology has as its theoretical achievements two ends, both of which are regarded as essentially useful, and within certain reasonable boundaries, they are useful. One is psychoanalysis and the other is psychotherapy. Psychoanalysis is the effort to understand man, to understand the reasons for his attitudes and for the various unreasonable emotions and thoughts that arise in him. Under analysis, a certain amount can be demonstrated. It can be shown, for example, how dangerous prejudice can be. We gain a very valuable insight into the reason for unaccountable pressures that distort the person, which damage the individual himself, and which bring upon him numerous misfortunes in life. It has been well demonstrated in a number of cases that the individual, heavily burdened by internal intensities, can damage his life, his health, his career, and his social standing by permitting these ancient grievances of his own temperament to continue to dominate action. Thus, if the person becomes too pressureful as the result of incidents which occurred in this lifetime, if the individual has reacted badly to all the experiences of life, if he has fallen under the glamour of self-pity, if he has inordinate ambitions, if he is determined to achieve his own ends regardless of cost to others, whatever unnatural, unreasonable, unethical intensity may affect him will certainly bring with it results that are detrimental to his happiness and peace of mind. Psychology, then, shows that a bad disposition does nobody any good. And this is a very basic and valuable discovery. The only answer that they do not seem to be able to work out at the present time is what to do with a congenital bad disposition. How it happens that some individuals seemingly are born in the objective case and never get over it. How it happens that some persons are difficult from the beginning, easily inclined to neurosis, likely to take the wrong angles and the wrong views of everything, whereas others, born in the same families, under the same social conditions, in the same races, and in the same countries, are much more docile, easily regulated, and more idealistic and constructive in their points of view. These problems are still tossed back into the mysterious bin of heredity and must remain there until some wiser solution is found. But there has been sufficient to prove, beyond doubt, the simple fact of mental hygiene, namely that as the individual thinks, he will pay in terms of happiness and health. Now, the psychoanalysis dealing with this phase of the problem leads naturally to psychotherapy. How are we going to get the individual out of his bad habits? This has resulted in a break into smaller schools of most of the larger psychological streams. There have been many different groups arise, each of which had a different approach to this problem of psychotherapy. Some hold that the most important thing is to place the individual under counseling, to keep him extroverting his pressures until he exhausts them. Others feel that the individual can gradually be taught to appreciate by a kind of inward experience the quality of his own mistake. And out of this will come gradually a rescuing or restoring of normalcy by the effort of the patient himself. Others have resorted to hypnosis, drug therapy, and everything that can be devised by modern science to help the individual to fight the tensions which his own pressures and dispositional intensities have created within him. To a measure, this type of psychotherapy has been helpful. It is especially helpful in advanced cases of psychiatry. But all in all, we cannot say that psychology as it is today is a perfect art or even nearly a complete science. Such is not the case. It is still a dependency, dependent upon the large structure of philosophy for its realities, for its integrities, and for its survival. Fortunately, the present trend is toward this realization. And where a few years ago, the psychologist was a very complacent person, certain that he had the final key to human happiness, he is now far less certain of this. And part of his increasing modesty is due to the circumstances of contemporary life. He is discovering, rather to his amazement, that although we have more psychologists than ever before, we have more mental illness than ever before. He is beginning to sense that something else is necessary, and that psychology, without certain internal integrations within its own structure, can contribute to problems rather than to their solutions. And working on this problem, psychology is concerned today more and more with the restoration of an ethical structure. In other words, it is seeking to be re-identified with the principal stream of philosophical descent. In the mystical way of looking at all of these problems, in the classical psychology, the ancients accepted certain facts that modern psychologists are loath to accept. They accepted, for example, the existence in man of a spiritual energy or a divine life principle. That this divine life principle animates all things, supplying them with their life requirements very much as the sun animates all of nature and sustains the infinite diversity of growth and unfoldment everywhere obvious in the natural world. That this inner light or life or power should be termed a spirit or spiritual principle is only consistent with the early experiences of human beings. Therefore, the ancients, for the most part, some exceptions, for the most part held the validity of a spiritual principle. That man was a motion of life through time and space. That this life had a certain fixedness in it somewhere. That this life was something doing something. It was not merely a series of interrelated phenomena with no essential basis. This life itself, according to the ancients, had as its primary purpose a mysterious motion called evolution or ideation. This life, at some primordial time prior to man's ability to restore such conditions in nature, was immersed within a material principle from which it gradually evolved what we call body. The ancients symbolized this primary union of life and matter in the seed, or the form of life in which the life itself is locked within some kind of a shell. This life, locked within matter, gradually unfolded, gradually strengthened, gradually flowed out, producing the phenomenon of growth. This growth we observe everywhere. We observe it in the growth of plants, of trees, of animals. We see it whenever we look around us in nature. We see things growing mysteriously but majestically, even as the great tree grows from the tiny acorn. And we seem to behold in this nature's eternal process of unfoldment. And according to most ancient peoples, spirit was unfolding through body. And in the process of its own unfoldment, it unfolded the body which it occupied. Therefore, it was the spirit itself that was forever building nobler mansions for its own purposes. The ancients recognized spirit and matter as the polarized opposites of a universal essence or principle. They did not regard matter as something apart from spirit, but as a condition of it. They did not represent or figure spirit as being isolated from matter. Rather, they regarded spirit and matter as the polarities of one eternal agent. And man's spiritual life, descending from the mysterious roots and sources in the unknown, uniting itself with body, ensouled body, and transformed body into a living thing. Body rising from the earth, passing through the infinite diversity of manifestation, which we call the evolutionary process, gradually unfolded its own potentials from a monocellular organism into the compound being which we call man. The action of life upon matter caused matter to take upon itself design or purpose. It was as though, as the German mystic Davy says, life placed its seal upon matter. And matter, therefore, received the impression of this seal and manifested the design, inscription, or monogram that was placed upon or cut into the seal. Davy calls this seal and its impression the signatura rerum. It is the great signature of the divine power. Now, when life seals matter with its monogram or its mysterious heraldic device, the seal itself is called form. For the union of life and matter always results in a compound. And this compound is a form. A form consisting of material elements held into some kind of a pattern by energy. This form, like the mysterious geometry of snowflakes, means that something has crystallized around patterns, around a magnificent geometry of life itself. And the ancients held that man was a compound consisting of this mingling and fusion of life and matter, and that as a result of this mixture or commixture of this chemical process in the universe, man became what we see, what we know, what we experience today. He became an informed or formalized being. Now, as the union of spirit and matter produced form, so according to the ancient belief, this fusion also produced a mysterious thing called soul. Soul was therefore the invisible counterpart of the fusion of spirit and matter. And then man became a creature possessing a form, possessing faculties, powers, perceptions, reflections, the capacity for meditation and concentration. When he developed the mysteries of memory and forethought and intuition and inspiration, as these powers began to develop within him, they resulted in the gradual development of a new creature. This new creature had a body similar to the bodies of animals. He had a life eternal in the light of God. But between this body and this spirit, there was emerging, evolving, and unfolding a mysterious individuality. This individuality was the person. This individuality was man, or manas, the ancient Sanskrit root word for man, also meaning the thinker. Thus man became a living, thinking being. And with his living and thinking, he reacted in an infinitude of ways to the challenge of his environment. We can trace this evolution back to the Stone Age. We can trace it back to the time when man first desired to perpetuate the records of his own kind by making crude drawings and sculpturings upon the walls of caves and on the faces of cliffs. We can see his struggle through the beginning of arts and sciences. We can see him discovering fire. We can find him gaining gradually skill in the hunt. We find him inventing weaving and pottery, little by little advancing himself. Other creatures that we know did not do these things. Some showed rudimentary tendencies to social organization, as the ant and the bee, but they never developed beyond a certain degree. We find man, however, going on and on, not only adjusting himself to the world in which he lived, but gradually developing the abstract faculties of the mind. We find him speculating and thinking about things. We find a religion arising in his consciousness. And little by little, this fusion of spirit and matter, producing, as we say, the rudimentary principle of mind, began to enrich this mind, and this mind in turn began to enrich the life of the person in the material world. And by degrees, over vast periods of time, the mind took leadership over the body, and more used the body for its own purposes. Man no longer simply existed to survive. As soon as mind began to take over, man began to think in terms of leisure. Man began to contemplate the possibility of an inner life apart from the mere struggle for survival. Out of leisure came the arts and sciences, the philosophies, the literatures, all of the music, the theater, the drama, dance, every development of man's psychic life. These all came from the leisure or the power of the individual to have a life inside, and a life which it was not necessary to completely smother in order to maintain physical existence. So man gradually began to conspire on how to gain for himself greater freedom from the stress of material need. He learned by degrees how to save the seed and augment the crops. He learned how, by industry, to make useful devices. He invented light so that his hours of darkness would not be so complete, and he would have greater time for contemplative life. Little by little, therefore, the human being built up between spirit and body a structure of experiences, a structure rich in the story of the struggle of an inner being to express itself. Now, religion may in some instances identify this inner being totally with spirit. But the animal has spirit. The bird, the fish, the insect, all these creatures have spirits. They are all alive. They are just as much alive as man. But they have never individualized this mysterious middle ground. They have never taken life and gradually given it a certain integration. They have never created the power to create leisure for themselves. They've never found the way to use this leisure. If these other creatures had ever gained this power and this skill, they would probably have long ago overwhelmed man, because they outnumber him, and in many ways they are infinitely more resourceful than he is. But they have never had this sense, this mysterious power of gaining mastery over destiny. So we find gradually in this middle distance between spirit and matter the arising of the true human being. We find him, therefore, suspended twixt heaven and earth, dominion wielding. He is like the Chinese triad of heaven, earth, and man. For in man, heaven and earth are locked, and they are also revealed. Man, through his own individuality, is gradually revealing the universe. And in so doing, he is also exploring, discovering, contemplating universal phenomena. Thus, the ancients were convinced that there existed this soul in body. that this soul is the highest expression that we have of the manifestation of universal energy. That it was a particular manifestation, that it was a highly personal one. The human soul cannot belong to anything except man. And the human soul could not come into existence until man became a self-responsible agent. The human soul has to gradually gain through experience. The human soul has to react to pleasure and pain. It has to discover its mistakes. It has to advance its virtues. It has to punish its defects. Until finally, because it has individuality, because it has a certain moderate determinism, which it calls free will, this soul is capable of growth, capable of becoming. It is also capable of limiting or delaying its own growth. But because this growth is part of universal life itself, it cannot completely destroy the power of itself to grow. It can damage this power, but it cannot frustrate its purposes. Thus man arises as the son of heaven and earth. He arises as having been endowed by nature with the richest part of natural heritage, and endowed by the divine principle with the potentials of his own divinity. Man then is indeed a creature in whose nature the ultimates and the extremes of existence are both bridged and reconciled. On this basis, then, we have the concept of the soul as it was understood by the Greeks and by most other ancient peoples. And because this psychic power gradually gained the knowledge of itself and gained the power to contemplate its own structure, its own majesty, and its own manifestation through the study of its consequences as a force in life, so man began to develop a science of his own soul. He gradually developed realizations of how the soul could be advanced in its purpose, how it could be retarded, what would enrich it, what would impoverish it. He also gradually came to know the needs of the soul, what was necessary to its growth and happiness, its normalcy and order. Plato gives us a considerable discussion of this particular subject. And like most of the Greek philosophers, he assumed that finally the soul was a geometrical equation. It was a kind of mathematical creature. It was a creature that could be best symbolized by numbers, by their arrangements, and by the unfoldment of the symmetrical Platonic solids. The soul also, in addition to all of these other characteristics, according to the Greeks, being, so to say, a product of the union of heaven and earth, could be lured away from its middle place by the various circumstances of life. The soul was perilously poised on the roaring ridge of heaven. It was truly in a middle ground or middle distance between extremes. And man's own abilities to maintain the equilibrium of the soul, these abilities determine very largely the health or sickness of his own psychic self. If the soul was caused by the intemperances of living to verge toward the body and become identical with it, then the individual was termed a materialist or a sensualist. Then it was that the soul, instead of regulating the body, became its slave. This is the allegory behind the story of Samson, who, having been blinded, was bound to the millstone of the Philistines. This soul that is blinded by materialism becomes, as it were, bound to the millstone of the material world and its problems, grinding out corn for profit, continually enslaved by the very body which was fashioned for its purpose and for its unfoldment. As the soul went or verged nearer and nearer to body, it was said to enter into a stupor or to become obsessed or possessed by body. It became numb and intoxicated with the pressures of the senses until finally this soul descended into a darkness, losing all sense of its own existence, forgetting that it was a living thing, and remembering no part of its divine origin. A point again brought out for the parable of the prodigal son, and in the Gnostic legends by the hymn of the robe of glory. The soul, having thus lost all sense of its own divinity, of its own nobility, became simply an instrument for the gratification of the sensory perceptions. Its thoughts were only in terms of the comforts of the body, the fulfillment of material ambition. It dealt in stratagems and spoils. It became a victim of conspiracies, and the mental powers which it possessed were used for tyranny, despotism, and deceit. Thus Plato describes the most unhappy and miserable state of the soul, in which it is therefore said essentially to enter into a state of hell. For as both the Greeks and Egyptians pointed out, hell was simply the soul imprisoned within body, limited by the tyrannies of the sensory perceptions, pressed on by the demoniacal forces of deceit, selfishness, and ignorance, and no longer capable of an existence in itself or even the awareness of its own nobility. Conversely, the soul, suspended in the middle distance between the divine and mortal, could verge toward the divine, could ascend from the tyranny of the body, and incline itself more and more to the contemplation of heavenly things. When the soul chose to join itself to the eternal source of its own being, this soul was said to become an idealist, no longer accepting the tyranny of body, renouncing those procedures and processes which might bind it to the delusion of the sensory perceptions. The soul sought rather the rarefied atmosphere of intuition and vision. Thus it was, according to the Greeks, that the soul might be raised up or lifted up by a mystery, so that it was no longer locked within a body. That the compound being no longer regarded the soul merely as the mental part of its own anatomy, but rather viewed it as a glorious winged creature, capable of soaring into the very presence of truth itself. The ancient mysteries of the Greeks, the Egyptians, the Hindus, and other nations which possessed the secret religious systems, these ancient mysteries had as their purpose the separation of the soul from the body without death. For it was assumed that this was a kind of philosophic death, in which the soul, transcending body and ascending from it, attained liberty or freedom and existed in the pure air of reality, even while the person was still embodied in a material constitution. The soul which thus liberated itself from body, even though still embodied, was also then believed to have attained an immortality. For the soul, once liberated by its own insight, could not in that embodiment or in any other future embodiment ever lose this enlightenment, because the soul in its own nature could not be embodied. And once it was free from the primordial ignorance which had brought with it from the beginning, once it had matured beyond the condition of ignorance, it could no longer be forced into that ignorance. It could no longer again be identified with body, so that while this person might be born again many times, he would be born and would at an early age or in coming maturity achieve the realization of the dignity of his own soul. This was the concept around which the primitive psychology of the ancients was built. It was built on the great concept of liberating the soul from sensuality. Liberating the soul not by forceful measures, not by some desperate discipline, but liberating it by persuasion, by gradually inviting it to contemplate nobility, by instructing it in the noblest and most gracious of the arts and sciences, by perfecting it in philosophy and religious insight, and by inspiring it to seek continuously and unfailingly for the spiritual source of its own life. It was this soul, therefore, that attaining a certain immortality was ultimately, as described by Pythagoras in the Golden Verses, reunited again with the divine power from which it came. This is the panorama of psychology as the ancients held it to be. We can see how modern psychology is a fragment of this, but lacking a larger picture, lacking the great moral inducements, lacking the great ethical institutions, lacking these systems of meditation and contemplation which led to the purification of the soul, lacking even a philosophy for the emancipation of the psychic life from bondage to matter, psychology cannot bring about the final end which it seeks to attain. It must therefore remain forever a partial science, unless it finally reaccepts into itself the full structure of the ancient learning to which it once belonged. Now, in addition to the problem of psychology, we must turn to the next phase of our problem, which is epistemology. The word epistemology comes from a Greek word which means knowledge. And the main problem and concern of epistemology is to discover the nature of knowledge. And this is a question which is of great importance to thoughtful people and no importance to the thoughtless. Many individuals have no interest whatever in knowledge. They accept certain things as knowable and certain things as not knowable, and that is the end. Or they think of knowledge as opposed to ignorance, knowledge being that which they know, ignorance that which others know. This situation we find everywhere in human experience. There are very few persons, regardless of the inconveniences under which they subject themselves, will admit that they do not know. Yet, actually, if we begin the study of knowledge, it helps to maintain in us an appropriate humility. What is knowledge? Here is a very difficult thing to define. Even the word itself presents great difficulties. For those who are not thoughtful, there are never any difficulties. But at the same time, there are never any results. But to the more cautious, to the more considerate, the problem of knowledge must presume something else. Knowledge can only exist if there is something to be known. Knowledge must therefore be dependent entirely upon the validity of that which can be known. Now, modern attitudes toward knowledge are quite different again from those of our classical ancestors. Modern individuals, particularly those following the humanistic persuasions, are inclined to assume that all knowledge must be relative, on the ground that ultimates do not exist until they occur. Therefore, there can be no knowledge beyond the condition of the moment, and the condition of another moment must be analyzed at another time. If there is no master plan, if growth is simply a growing up in space, and all growth itself is determined primarily by incident and accident, then we have no ground for more than relative knowledge. We cannot assume that there is any grand plan of existence. If we are therefore to assume that we are making the only plan there is, that there can be no plan apart from us or others of our kind somewhere in space. If space is growing up only because of the pressure of growth within it, is growing up in isolation and by chance alone, if everything has the right to become anything that it wants to be, and there is no boundary except the boundary imposed by the effort of that which is growing, then we have no absolute knowledge. We can only have, we might say, an absolute fact, namely the fact of infinite growth, without any supervision of any kind. That this universe is like a field of weeds that will keep on going forever simply because of the tenacity of the weeds themselves. The classical point of view on this again differed from that of the average modern position. For most ancient nations established a concept of archetypes. They insisted that somewhere in the infinite mind of things, in the eternal nature of the creating power itself, was a plan.